And this week of sessions is intended to be a conversation, a reflection on the way in which the non-verbal languages, the hidden languages of worship, shape our practices. And I think they shape our practices in good and bad ways. And so out of our conversation, I hope we'll both explore some of the themes in the summer book. I hope if you don't have a copy, you'll take a look at it. And then drawing primarily from this book by Don Sellier's Worship and Spirituality. And he's a professor of theology and liturgy at Emory University in Atlanta and is a church musician and organist. And so I'm setting out this class as a proposal to us for conversation. And in today's session, what I'd like to do is introduce the proposal for the week of discussions and then set a context for that discussion. And then each of the next sessions through the week will look more deeply at one of the hidden languages of worship, asking two questions broadly about each of those, asking a question about the ways in which that hidden language is a part of our culture generally, and then in the tradition of the Christian church and especially Christian liturgy, how has that hidden language played a role, both in shaping us well and shaping malforming us. So the proposal is, in order for liturgy to form us well in the practices of faith, we must learn the hidden languages of worship. And that proposal, I think, is provocative for us to think about because we often think in language, in words. That's the cognitive realm that we live in. And so these languages, time, space, silence, gesture, and movement, though very influential, very powerful, often are reflected on. They're a part of the world that we live in. For instance, the shape of the room that we're sitting in right now frames the way that our discussion will go. And if we didn't take time to analyze that and reflect on it, it would shape us without our noticing. And if I had formed it in rows, regimented rows with an aisle down the middle, it would have had a very different feel. So that's the proposal. And I wanted to, as we go through this week, and I'll return to this at the end of our session today, but I want each one of you to choose one of the languages and to pay attention to that as we go through the week. For instance, you could choose silence and pay attention to moments of silence in the rhythm of your day here, and particularly moments of silence as they occur in our worship life together. And just reflect on it. Be reflective yourself. And I think if each of us does that, it will be rich for our own reflection about our participation in worship and the way in which silence is necessary for some of the practices of faith. But I also hope that you'll bring those insights as you have them into our discussions as we go through the week. So, in order to set a context for dialogue about this proposal, I wanted to spend a moment briefly talking about these four areas which are part of the proposal. And this session will be brief today, briefer than it could have been, but that just means that we have less time to talk together about each one of these. And the pattern I'd like to do as we move through them is to briefly just surface some of the immediate reflections that you have when you hear the words worship or liturgy or ethics. And then out of that, I'll both say something especially about these words and their derivation, and then the particular way in which I'd like to push us to think about those words in talking about this proposal. So to begin with, I just ask you to throw out the words or images that come to mind when you hear the word ethics. Ethics. Do's and what comes to mind? Do's and don'ts.
Right and wrong.
Right and wrong.
Morals.
Morality. Let me just jot some of these down.
Monica Lewinsky.
Thank you. it's interesting that the first thing that came to mind for people was, or could be summarized as rules, right and wrong, do and don't. And the, I started with ethics.
That's okay, that's all
anyway.
Right. Let's put an arrow.
Put an arrow down there. And we, if we think about moral development, we pick up do's and don'ts, rights and wrongs, just in the ethos of our home. And ethos is the derivation of the word ethics, and it originally had to do with customs and habits which weren't reflected on, which were just a part of the rhythm of our city, our nationality, race, tribe, whatever, our family life. And so we pick up those, but we think of do's and don'ts as rules on signs, stop signs, regulations, speed limits, not so much the unreflected on habits and customs that are part of early family life. And I'd like to push us back beyond rules, which is often where philosophical ethics starts, asking about what the action should be, what's the right action. These are some basic areas where philosophical ethics focuses its attention. And so to ask the question, what's the right thing to do, is to ask about the level of the action itself. And I want to push us, considering this original concept of ethos as custom or habit, down to the agent, partly because I'm interested in us thinking about Christian ethics. Philosophical ethics will often ask, what's the right thing to do? And I think for Christians, we have to take a step back and say, who are we? And to answer that question, we have to say, who is God? And who is God for us? And out of that comes an understanding of who we are, and then who we should be, and what we should be doing. So I want us to think about the level of the agent as we think about that. And that's particularly because these hidden languages form us in ways that we don't think about always. We don't think about what's the right or wrong way to set up worship when we go into the space. Someone does, usually, or someone did at one time. But we don't often consciously think of that as a right or wrong structure of the seating in the church. Another consideration that we'll talk about is the context, the particular context of our cultures and the communities that we come from. I hope you'll think about your home church, your home community, the ways in which you participate in American culture through your, maybe through your ethnic heritage, the celebrations in Norwegian communities or Hispanic communities, but also the context of your worshiping community and your particular religious tradition, whether it's Lutheran or another one. So that's a suggestion to you, an encouragement to you about a way to think about ethics that will help us to think about and unpack this proposal. What occurs to you when you hear the words worship or liturgy? What are the associations?
Praise.
Trauma. Drama.
I didn't understand drama.
Drama.
That's great. Maybe we should put drama out there. People resonated. Other associations people have?
Church.
Ritual.
Service.
Which could be another word up here. Worship, liturgy, service. Mm-hmm. How about a differentiation between worship and liturgy? Do they mean something different when you hear them? What would you say your understanding of the difference is? How do they resonate differently?
I kind of think of worship as a verb.
As a verb? Something one does.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Worship.
Yeah.
And liturgy is a noun.
As a form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That would fit the derivation from Old English, the word worship meaning to give, to offer honor or to give work. It's a, I suppose, a royal act, some sort of giving the due to the king or queen, but also by correlation to God as the king. But then liturgy coming from Laos people and Aragon work, also a verb in its original usage. It could have meant paying taxes. It was just a public work, a public service that one would do. And it could equally be paying taxes to the Roman Empire, or it could be paying service in the temple by doing your stint as a priest. The, we were talking this morning about Zacharias in the temple, and one, I don't know the Greek words that are used for his, for that language of him going to the temple to serve his turn. But it undoubtedly has the similar idea. But I think now our association often with liturgy is that it is a form of an ordering of how we do worship together. And as our discussion continues, I just hope that we keep a broad sense of what worship and liturgy are, so we don't think that, for instance, the Free Church Baptist tradition doesn't have its own orderings. Because one of the key things in this proposal is that congregations and traditions have ordering as a part of their worship life, and that those orderings over time shape the people who participate in it. And so one of the main things about worship that I want us to think about is the way in which it patterns our approach to God and the way in which God has promised to meet us in worship. So there's a certain sort of necessity of worship for us because it's a particular place that orders our life. The difference between worship and liturgy and how I speak will be more or less interchangeable. The course worship and ethics, it could be liturgy and ethics as well. Then, as we go through the week, the question in this proposal about forming us well in practices of faith, sure, makes sense in terms of the summer theme about guiding our feet in the ways of peace, and draws on this book. But you could ask the question, well, why read this book now? Why write this book now? Why should we worry about how well we're formed in the faith? And one of the reasons that I think this is an important question for us to ask now is because we're in the process of an incredible renewal and reopening of questions about worship and Christian community and what it means to be Christian, exactly because it's not anymore a given in our culture that everyone is Christian and that Western society is Christian. And so in a context where some people are calling it post-Christendom, we're not any longer a Christian West, then all of a sudden, it's not just in the water we drink when we're children. It can be if we have a very intentional Christian home, but it's not necessarily in our society. It's a predominantly secular society. And so that in a time of crisis for a community, in a time when a community or a group of people feel they've lost their bearings, they ask again, what is our history? What are our practices? How do we pass on to our children this way of life? And so that raises the question of practices. We can talk about this in a number of ways. This set of commentaries is simply the breaking down of the definition in the book in the introductory chapter. Things people do over time in response to God for the life of the world. And I think that this first one is the one that I associate most with practices. It's, Susan.
You've left a word out in that first one that has become one of the most important words to me.
Okay, let me add it.
things people do together.
Together.
That even when we honor our bodies individually, we are part of a community that does this as a people.
Mm-hmm.
And that is also an extraordinarily counter-cultural word. So mm-hmm. I like the word together there. Things mm-hmm. people do together mm-hmm. all the time.
And I noticed as I read the book, Practicing Our Faith, each chapter addresses the question of how the practices are part of communal life and how they shape communal life. And that's certainly the intention of this question, because it's not only the way in which these hidden languages shape individuals, but the way they shape a community together. So, thank you. What, when you hear the word practice in your everyday life, where do you hear it? Think for a moment about where you hear that term.
Violin.
Violin.
Medical.
Right. Medical practice. What do you think that refers to when someone says, I practice medicine? Is it like practicing a violin? Mm-hmm. It's not quite the it's not quite the same.
Well, practice you medicine. Know, if you're learning violin or learning voice or learning piano, you call it practicing.
Right.
But when you're a shaped performer, you still practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that doesn't necessarily mean that you're getting better. It means that you're maintaining.
Right.
And a physician repeats. I mean, I just know this from singing in France, that the word for practice is repetition.
Yeah.
Émission.
Yeah.
And you're always repeating. and that a physician repeats all
yeah.
the time.
Yeah.
And I repeat all the time.
Yeah, as a repertoire of procedures.
I suppose positions do get better too. I mean, that's why we value the more experienced ones.
Right.
But it's also used in the sense of, in our family, it is our practice to visit my parents in early December. It does have repetition in it,
yeah.
But it's also, it is how our family does its life.
Yeah.
And I think about that with the physician. I mean, what is his practice? It's medicine. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other vocations that we connect practice to? Do you practice teaching? Or
law.
You practice
law.
Practice law. Mm-hmm.
Sonia has a midwifery practice. That's the name of her. Group.
That turns it into a noun. So that works both as verb and noun.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
An interesting thing to me is
meditation.
Yeah.
Practice
right.
meditation.
Which isn't the exact, I mean, it has the meaning of practicing in order to get better, but it's also the meaning of a sort of, this is what I do. More identity.
Talk about practicing. Christians are practicing Jews.
Right. Are you practicing? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I like, there is a connection, I was thinking, or a parallelism to the word discipline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, practice of discipline, which is you're following a way. So you have a discipline of music. What's your discipline?
Mm-hmm.
My discipline was literature. College. I was a disciple of literature. I was a follower of that. So I wonder, kind of interesting juxtaposition between practice and discipline.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have a parallel word between disciple and practitioner. Maybe that's the
mm-hmm.
It's interesting. Some things we don't practice. We don't, like you were saying, we don't practice. We don't say practice reading. No, as a literature major, you know, you're still
first grade practice is reading.
Right,
right.
But many of us are still practicing that art of interpretation. Whatever, we don't use that particularly.
The Greek word, it actually I think is used in much of Greek philosophy, but significantly in Aristotle in terms of the way that this book draws on it through some contemporary philosophers who draw on Aristotle. But in Greek philosophy, the word praxis doesn't refer to the creation of something. So say if you were practicing your instrument, that would be praxis. So if you were, say, a composer and writing a piece, you wouldn't use the word practice for that. Praxis, you would use the word poesis, which is another verb for doing something, but it evokes doing something that's creative of something new. So there's an interesting distinction that was developed in Greek philosophy between praxis and poesis. And it's been developed in such a way that now we talk about practices as embodying in the tradition of that practice, standards for what good performance of that practice is. And I suppose that would be similar to the use of the practice of medicine. There are certain standards of what does it mean to practice medicine well? What is a good doctor? But originally it had that character, something that one just does over and over again. It's something mundane every day. And oftentimes in biblical literature, it's used negatively, referring to the practices of the heathen or the practices of the Roman cults or whatever. It's referred to as things that aren't good to do. And so there's some interesting historical twists on the word that both have and haven't influenced how we talk about it now. But I think it's important to think about it in an ordinary way. Oftentimes, the practices are very ordinary things. In the Honoring the Body chapter, there's a discussion of simply bathing. And that has all sorts of layers of meaning for us. It's a provocative symbol because of baptism and the way in which bathing takes on all sorts of other important ritual associations for Christians. But fundamentally, it's a human, universal act of cleaning one's body. So in this list, these are the practices that have chapters in this book. On each of these practices is honored by a chapter, but there are other practices as well. And so I hope as we talk together this week, thinking about how these larger frames are a part of and shape our practices, that we imaginatively include 13 and 14 and 15 other practices that we're involved in our lives and our communities of faith. The last of these four components of the context for discussing the proposal is the hidden languages. And in a sense, it's not necessary to explicate it that much. It's just to bring it to our attention that these are powerful things that are a part of our life. For instance, if you have a friend whose family derivation is from the South Mediterranean or other countries where they're very gestural and animated, then to think of them speaking without gesture would be to think of them without speaking. Mm-hmm. Their words are only a part of how they speak to you. And if you think about the way in which gesture underlies and gives meaning to the words, then you realize that the words can't bear all the meaning. For instance, if I was to say, well, you know, it's really nice to have you here today, we're going to talk about this, and it's very interesting. And there's a sense in which your gestures can complement the words that you say and give integrity to them, or they can speak something different. We talk about reading someone's body language and asking what they're really saying. Someone comes in for an interview and they're sitting like this and they're turned sideways and looking at you. And that speaks more than whatever they might say. Mm-hmm. So I hope that in our conversations together we can think together carefully about the ways in which these hidden languages are actually all over the place and very powerful in our society and in our Christian tradition, and the way in which they're absolutely necessary in different ways for us to be formed well. And without thinking about them carefully, what we risk, I think, is the danger of, we were talking, Bruce and I were talking earlier about the way in which music in our society has changed because the training of people in music has changed, which then changes the needs of the people who buy music, which then changes the things that the publisher is willing to publish, which then changes what's available to people who are singing. And so then there's this kind of circle of malformation, if you're interested in a certain standard of music, that goes on. And I think that those sorts of circles of malformation happen in such a way that we lose the perspective to be able to say what else could there be. And this happens equally with space. You can have a absolutely cutting-edge church built in 1952 in terms of the sanctuary architecture, and then you come to it in 1998 and you are just absolutely constrained by the theology operative in the architect's mind in 1952. And so without going into a discussion of that space, what that space allowed and encouraged when it was built and how it constrains the community now, it's really hard to re-envision a new space. And there are things that, for instance, in my home parish, it's a neo-Gothic parish with huge stained glass windows going up the side and an altar way up on the other side of the choir going up the front wall. And they're trying to have a 9:45 contemporary service with soprano saxophone in that sanctuary and create an intimate, sort of interactive feel. And it's a very difficult endeavor because the space is so strong. So those are the sorts of things that I'm proposing that we engage in.
I just have one comment on the hidden languages. One thing I notice a lot as an ESL teacher is that all these hidden languages are completely different in every culture, and even within American culture, and that can create so many miscommunications.
Mm-hmm.
And like the eye contact thing is an interesting one between teacher and student. And many cultures, you're supposed to not look at
the student.
Yeah, you're not supposed to look at somebody who's in a higher position than you.
Yeah.
And yet here, we're supposed to pay attention and look. Mm-hmm. And so things like that, if you aren't consciously aware of them, it can create so many problems, and you don't even know why the problems just explode without even a visible reason. So I think with a group of Chilean students coming here today, it's very worth thinking about this and paying attention.
Right. Well, I hope you'll bring in thoughts about that because you have lots of experiences with that teaching yourself. Let's just take a few minutes at the end here. Before we end, I want to do two things, but I'd like to just have other responses generally. At the end, I'd like to have each one of us just take a moment to think, what hidden language would I like to focus on this week? And then I'm a very new teacher, and I have evaluation forms that I want to try getting responses on every session that I teach, just so ideas are in people's minds, and that we all learn. Susan?
I'm thinking of a hidden language that maybe is up there, but isn't explicitly up there.
Uh-huh.
That is the language of acoustic, of the acoustic space of worship. Mm-hmm. Is it designed acoustically for communal song, or only for amplified voices, only for... Because of where I have served, I feel as if the acoustical language in the room can be my worst enemy or my greatest friend in presiding over liturgy. And I don't know if that space,
it's definitely part of space.
Okay.
But it could be raised under silence too, because the counterpart of silence is sound, and the space has something to do with how sound is used and therefore what sort of silence you can have.
But I think when people design churches or worship sacred space, they do think of positioning of things, should be a half circle, should be a whole,
Right.
But what how do we value the unamplified human voice?
Right.
That's a huge question for me, and I've been in churches where it's very clear that they're set up more like theaters, and everything is to be deadened except the person at the microphone, and that voice comes through. But to elicit prayers from the community that everyone could hear is impossible.
Mm-hmm. Right. It just isn't.
Well, also the older buildings of stone, it was buildings in this country too, but primarily in Europe, where the spoken word doesn't work at all. Everything had to be carried in chant, because the spoken word would just be so that music is the only language that works in such a church.
Yeah, we need to ask the question, what acoustical world was this building intended for originally? Because oftentimes the worship practices of that era aren't existent any longer, but there's many people worshiping churches that are on that model.
I worked a long time in a church where they had, it looked like a neo-Gothic, it looked like a Gothic structure, but they had foam on the walls made to look like stone, so that everything was deadened.
Yeah.
So that the spoken word could sound, but it fooled you visually.
Yeah.
It looked like a Gothic space.
Yeah.
And then when the style of that place changed, they took and sprayed a silicone solution, 9 layers of silicone all over the ceiling and the walls to harden that surface again, so that they could make the music speak more. And then they had to put in a very expensive PA system to enable the preacher to speak. And they would have been better off to have torn it down and started with a new space.
Then the space probably would have been lovely.
Take
the money to have that large space.
Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering, it seems to me in the hidden languages, we're kind of talking about the spoken word, which is more sort of logical, discursive, versus the sung, which has something else. And I don't know, you might include that under silence, but it seems like it's kind of a type of communication too, the sound, the human sound that's valued, whether it's the logical voice or the.
Well, for me, it's. I want to ask, what are we thinking underneath, or what is the theology that is informing a room that's set to silence everything but one person in a microphone? Mm-hmm. What are we saying here?
Right.
And how is that forming us as a people? When you sit in a sanctuary with padded pews and rugs on the floor, and the only people you can hear singing during congregational song is you and the woman behind you and your sister beside you, and that feels like that is the congregation, it feels to me that is forming us. It's forming us in small pockets rather than as a body. It forms us. I guess that's what I'm interested in. How does even acoustic space, what are we saying theologically, what are we valuing, and how in the end does that form us as a people? So, because I have thought that it leads us more and more towards performance worship, because then you can sit in a quiet place and hear things amplified. Mm-hmm. So it's soloists and ensembles. Congregational song is sacrificed for that. And so maybe it's space, maybe it's silence, but
it's definitely space. On the day we consider space, we're going to look at some characteristic architectural types through the history of the church, and you can see explicitly changes around concerns about what you can hear and who needs to be heard and who needs to sing or speak. So I think those questions are really central to the question of space and what formation is intended and who's intended to be formed.
Another practical thing that's about to happen, we worshiped all worshiped in tonight's liturgy, tonight's work among us is to give thanks for this space that has carried us through the winter, and to make a procession into where we'll be worshiping all summer, which is a very different space. And my community that I pastor feels, we grieve it. They feel lost, prayers are not heard as well, they feel swallowed up in something that's bigger, sometimes bombarded by too much stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very, we might be keep our eyes and ears open about how we move into that space, try to configure it in some way that speaks what we choose to have spoken there, but this is a huge move for us. John won't be here for it, but this is the space he'll think of as sacred, and now we would be asking all these winter people to transfer their do you have allegiance to that sacred space?
Well, it's one of these, it's an issue here, I think. Our formation in a place happens over time and through building memories in that space.
Very important.
Especially when the group is small and largely invested in the character of that worship. When it's a big congregation and only a few people plan and leave, then that doesn't happen as strongly. But here especially, I think that's...
Mm-hmm. We have community members who just don't want to come to worship in the summer, feel like it is their worship.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's no way to make it small and intimate in that big room. The space and the number of people dictate what can be done and what can't be done.
Yeah.
It's a powerful thing, because when you, in a congregation, when you try to, I suppose, to change any of those, but I'm specifically thinking of the space, it just arouses anger, antagonism, all kinds of things, like you're saying, we have the church just exactly built in 1952.
So was I, now be careful.
But to say, well, I think we should maybe move the altar area now down here and take the pews out in front here and put some chairs around here.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's God that's being disrupted.
Yeah.
That's an interesting question. The acoustical question is one with space, and another interesting question exactly is, where do people see the holy in the space? What's the primary symbol in space?
That's a good question.
These folks were telling me about their a congregation they saw in Portland, where the architect had designed dark blue stained glass for the congregational space, and then hidden clear glass that allows light to shine on the altar. And so the congregation is in a very poorly lit space, and the altar is bathed in white light. And so that really is extremely strong use of light in order to indicate to the congregation where God is, and has a strong theological formation on the people who are there. So
when I was here before, we always had fire there in the winter for worship.
Yeah.
And that, when I came back 4 summers ago, whenever when I came back, and the fire wasn't there anymore, I realized that that's what worshiping in this room meant to me, was that fire.
Yeah.
I didn't grow up in a church where they had fire in the
room. Right.
But during the 8 months that I spent here, that was it.
Yeah.
That was the symbol of worship in this room. And people gathered around that fire, and whoever was in charge of Vespers was one of the people in the circle.
Yeah.
But it was like that fire was the center, and that's a very primitive symbol and a very powerful one. I mean, I felt myself really sucked right into the ages of ages by doing that. And when I came back, I was sort of angry with this room.
Yeah.
I didn't like it anymore because the fire wasn't there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I hope these stories continue to animate our discussion as the week goes on. Mm-hmm. I invite you just to take a minute and center yourself and consider one of these. Even if you don't come to another session this week, I invite you and challenge you to just choose one and be aware of that and reflect on that this week as you live and worship here. I thank you all for coming.